Lovers in the Guise of Wolf Gods. The original was published in Japanese in 1966 by the poet Mutsuo Takahashi. This translation is by me, Jeffrey Engels. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanliness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves. 1. The wolf is tree, gale, grass. The wolf runs through forest sky, wind over the face of the earth. Trees scream, grass hums. The soul stands stark naked, innards covered in blood. Fangs of breath, red of a scream, the curtain of darkness creases, flapping in the air. Teeth crack and crunch, white foam. Claws rake the snowy mud. The wolf by the tree, gale and grass. The tree wolf is wind, and the gale and the grass, wolf. 2. Who will eat this fire? Who will run with wind? Who will tear apart the heart convulsing in his hand? Who will change the forest covered in green to woods brimming with blowing snow? In a flash, change a nest of love to a clump of infertile grass. The wolf, agile darkness, eats of fire, filling his starving flanks. He gallops with the wind. In his fur coat of 1,000 glittering needles, warm blood soaks his flint teeth and claws. With frozen breath, the wolf, spirit of winter, blinding powder of bone, changes the young forest into a forest of death, and eyes of fire into eyes of mud. 3. When he suckles at my breast, the man becomes an infant wolf. He chews with long, heavy bites on my pale peach nipple until even the last drop is sucked away. When milk comes no more, blood and pain spill forth. Blood sucked away, I fade and swoon. In unconscious dreams filled with fear, without noticing, I too had become a wolf just like him. 4. Our love devours us, a love that tears with the teeth. In our eyes exchanging glances are trees in flame, tearing, devouring the backs of our kissing mouths, fangs of breath. Seething blood spouts out and instantly freezes. Our torture is sympathy. Pain is pleasure. Our wiry hair shudders around our long shadows as we embrace. 5. Night in the park bushes, lovers pull the wolves' heads completely over their own. Wolves pull the heads of lovers over their own and starve on the summit of the moon. 6. A wolf couple dances where their chests rub together, soft fur against soft fur. The small bird of love is crushed to death. A standing couple clinks their glasses of thick wine, the color of blood. Upon them, the downy fur of air shines with full luster. On a long couch, the couple tilts their ears toward a record churning out bloodthirsty music. With shuffling steps, the couple slides into the hallway shadows and suck blood from one another's necks bent backward. In the garden, a couple kills a rosebud on the edge of a fountain that boils over. A sickly, thin finger blurs its fresh blood. One wolf faces the wall and silently strikes out love poetry on a typewriter. The ink of the typewriter is a warm, sanguine red. 7. Jostling saints of stained glass windows shattering into tiny fragments continue to call out and be born in the dark gloom inside the tilting bell. Powdered silver of countless echoes, clusters of chinistas trailing downwards. Frightening ruinous gold hemming in storm clouds. Inside the bushes, a fully cloaked wolf howls, and lovers drink continuously of one another's blood. 8. In the cemetery where dead souls and maggot-filled flesh hold their breath and whisper, he stepped on the brakes. Tires squealed and slid over thick grass. Wrapped in our silence, we flung away our coats and threw off our underclothes, suddenly embracing as if in anger. Outside, the rowan tree grazed our window. It was as if the dead were saying, we want to live, but in our moans and gushing pain, we ignored them. 9. A glass jar holding honey-colored alcohol, a glass pot full of rock candy, a tiny flask of perfumed oil, a mortar of poison. The glass of the ceiling suddenly shatters. Fragments glitter among fragments as the avalanche down the roaring navy blue. Feeling the awe of a fragment, for a moment, the city of glass echoes above the earth and shatters into pieces. Right then, the lovers pull the wolves' heads over their own. 10. Facing the round sky, towers jostle, sharp points glitter, 1,000 points ring, 1,000 points echo, the pigeon clock rings through the universe, a cuckoo clock screams, a clock owl shows its red mouth. The pendulum of the great clock of heaven springs out of place. The springs flip, gears snap, and fly off in opposite directions. The Roman numerals 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 turn somersaults on the face and fall. Beloved lovers quickly pull the wolves' heads over their own. These men who love each other, naked and in pairs, fall in the pose of their love.
Plexus, Ian Hatcher. Buoy, bobbing, a smooth calm suture, open to closing, water reaches over, swimming, encasing, reaches over, at arm's length, water, no, not opposite, no folding, like swimming, not opposite, casing, fluid. Like swimming, folding, yes, switch, yes, no less than, arm's length, folding, in flesh kit, dissolving, sand, figures, sanding, no less than, yes, switch, yes, a buoy, it is bobbing, fingers, fanning, flesh, dissolving, streaks, in rhythms, water in my mouth, words in my mouth, wires in my mouth, water in my mouth, words in my mouth, water in my mouth, water, words, water, water, words. Water, open. Stopcock, Ian Hatcher. Coloratura, stop. Cock, when you blame, you find. Vulgar demonstrations, indefensible. Frigidity steps on wire, indispensable. Metal harmonics, vivavoci, physical, not anatomical. Hollow, sepulchral. Wooden, collapsed lungs fall and drift, fill up with others, becoming rigid, distrusting lovers. Without supporting words, our muscles contract. Arousing cool streams of admonition, reflecting you. As you are a plaything. Self prolonging quiet night, a yawn it excites pupils. Dual refracting, dimming image, backward tipping trunk descendant, apparatus independent decisions, a body conscious of two minds, fusing, tonal spine, curling, helpful, harmful, vibrations we feel. In deep, resounding strokes of tenderness. Gestures for protection, we just want to rise and to fall in tandem inside sparking safety lines. Dummy gymnastics, artificial bloom, self-diluting tonics as the room is dissolving, an internal music kindling, rising, mirror organ crescendo ever alive. Steely flames licking, devouring, a heavy acid heaving, saturating, a mechanical bullfight, charging. Master, this golden age of singing. Softly.
You're Sick by Kelly McGee and Carol Guess. We said in sickness and in health, and the state made it legal. I wore yellow and you wore blue. Together we shimmered between Hunter and Emerald. We hired a DJ. Guests slept on the floor. We were one of the first of our kind to divorce. My lips pursed, your fingernails sharp. I deleted your email, your number, your ring. Our friends were angry, as if we'd done it to them. A few years later, we met at a conference. I was on business. You ran the hotel. You discounted my stay, sent a bottle of wine. You were generous and cheerful, and used my full name. That night, the phone rang while I was taking a shower. We talked about rain, what we missed about thunder. Later that night, you knocked on my door. We didn't mention our invisible we. After the conference, I called and texted, but you didn't answer. A few months later, I worked up the nerve to visit the hotel, a day's drive away in a minor city. Don't forget she took you to court. But I'd forgotten everything except the taste of your mouth. When I got to the hotel, I tried to page you. I repeated your name over and over. No one at the hotel had ever heard of you. I paced the lobby, trying to decide what to do. I decided to eat dinner in the hotel restaurant. The waiter sat me near the kitchen, which bothered me until I realized I could see everyone in the room, suits and soldiers, families and prostitutes. At first, I didn't notice you in a chair by the window. Lipstick, and you dyed your hair. You were talking to a very beautiful woman. The wine was the wine you'd sent to my room. I finished my dinner. As I left the restaurant, I dropped the check on your table and smiled at your date. You wore a name tag, but it wasn't your name. You looked up at me and your eyes glazed with panic. Later that night, you knocked on my door. Just to be sure it was you, I called out your old name and your new name, both. "It's me," you said. I wasn't sure which me you meant, which name to use, but it didn't matter. You ran your fingers through my hair. You pressed me up against the sink and things happened which weren't supposed to happen now that we weren't together. You had the key to every room. In one of those rooms, you made me sick. Sickness slid from lips to cheek, hairline to hip bone, bruise to nick. Your sickness swam the skeins of my blood, but I didn't know. I didn't know anything. Your new name was Yetta. Your old name also began with Y, but I was beginning to wonder if your old name was fake. Were you Yetta, Yelena, or Yumi, Yvonne, or Yolanda, Isolda, or Yel? I stayed in the hotel for a week. Every morning you slipped me a key, and every evening you looked slightly different. You walked into the room, and in 5 seconds flat we were on the bed. I made you get up and take off the comforter. "No offense," I said. "I'm sure it's clean." I didn't call out your name during sex. I praised other things. Finally, I asked about Yetta. On casual Fridays, we change our names to whatever. I rolled you over and straddled you and pinned your hands to the headboard. "Tell me the truth." "The truth about what?" "Anything." "Anything?" "Something." "I'm sick." I unpinned your hands. "It's contagious." "You're kidding. This isn't a joke. Get out of my room." "Don't you want to know what I gave you?" I went into the bathroom and locked the door. You turned on the TV. I could hear conservative pundits in the shopping channel. I flooded the shower, bathtub, and sink. When I opened the door, you were gone. It took me a while to notice the note taped to the phone. "Dear Emily, please don't contact me again. I've moved on, and so should you. I thought you could handle something casual, but clearly you're still an emotional vortex. Also, I'm sorry I made you sick, but it's not that bad. You might even like it. X. Y. I read the note several times. Then I lay on the bed and scanned my body like in yoga class, except I was looking for you. Whatever you left behind in me, the microchip, the shard of stained glass you slid behind my knee or into the crook of my arm, marks like a spider bite, the venom already in my bloodstream. "What is it?" I said to the empty room. "Where is it?" I put a hand over my throat, felt for the pulse. My fingers found it. Thump, thump, and then it stopped. I pressed harder. Minutes passed, and then, just as abruptly, the thumping returned. Water spilled over the side of the bathroom sink and soaked the carpet. Someone knocked at my door. "You might even like it. Something casual. I've moved on." An ache welled in my throat like tears, just below the place I'd felt my pulse stop and restart. My skin came alive. The room rolled. Thump, thump, and I was out the hotel door into this city, your city, carrying some invisible piece of you. You were inside me in some crucial way, and the you in me made me do things. I bought baseball hats, vodka. I slipped into your accent, borrowed your syntax. I lost weight, ground my teeth. I even phoned your mom once, just to hear her voice, and she called out a name that wasn't yours and wasn't mine. Eleanor, she said, and I said yes, and she said, I told you not to contact me here. We were all other people, acting out lives as if we owned them. I cut my hair, affected a swagger, laughed loudly at things that weren't jokes. The sickness in me built. I introduced myself as Eleanor, gave your hometown as my own, developed a taste for raw oysters. As you, I became a regular at bars I'd never gone to, and I used facts about serial killers to hit on women. As you, I never went home alone. I didn't tell the women I slept with that I was sick. They wouldn't understand what was wrong with them until they went to the doctor, maybe, complaining that they didn't feel like themselves. It's an illness, the doctors would tell them. You're not yourself. They were me, and I was you, and you were someone else. We were all shifting places, pretending we didn't see ourselves walking down the street. I married one of these women. I told her my name was Edith, hers Yaris. She could have been you, far gone. I was far gone too, but something in her mouth reminded me of the old me and you the old you. When I told her I was sick, she said she was too. We didn't know what that meant, and by that point we didn't care. We traded my place or yours for hotel rooms, one after the other, where I ran my fingers through her hair, pushed her up against the sink. She touched my lips and told me words she wanted me to say, broom and handbag and skillet. She fell in love after our third date, third room. I felt how different it was to be in love as you, how distant. I finally understood you better. I thought Yaris was close enough. Marry me, I said, her fingers in my mouth. I'd like to say we found each other again, one sickness a cure for the other, and that Yaris became you and I became me. It happens. You hear stories of people who find each other again a year later, 15 years, 50. I wish I could say that we changed enough to make us fit again, but it wasn't like that. Yaris turned picky and dull, and I left her in a hotel room, locked in the bathroom, faucets gushing. Dear you, I wrote, this isn't working. I'm sorry. Restrained myself from, it isn't you, it's me. I walked out of that hotel feeling free. Did it matter that it was just the next phase of the sickness if it felt like being cured? It was enough that I no longer waited for your call, no longer looked for you in crowds. I no longer saw couples that looked like you and me, maybe they were you and me, and felt sick about their luck.
Bird introduces herself. I was born once, in a park or a fruit grove or a red brick house or a closed eye, I don't care. I climbed a tree until it thinned to nothing and its branches cracked and fell. I said I'd stay there till the sound of breaking brought me down. No shrinking violet, I hid from the world to better see it. The way I played ball as a kid, but never scored, never dared to, hurling free throw after failed free throw until the air horn scorched my ears, like nails on blackboard, like the walls of stacked bleachers opened and closed, and the long hooked pole the janitor spun in his hands to raise the backboards, see? The strangeness was the only part I wanted.
Bird, age 16, contemplates God. If God loves me, he must feel conflicted. If God has a slogan for his white-hot supernatural existence, it must be, I'm less happy than I let on. If God has a face, it must hint at a midlife Rimbaud with the epic shadow of a South Jersey speed line humping past Camden mid-July. If God has a foot, I'd stomp it, am stomping it. If God has a thumb, I'd suggest he use it to move down the proverbial road. If God has a message for my ears, it will come damningly via digital jukebox. Must have been these heaven-driven winds that drowned you. If a teenage Jesus once hit his knees, penitentiary style, for some senior deity, it can't have been his wrung-out bearded dad, but rather someone sharp and resourceful and getting wicked fucked up. a god even God could get behind. I bet he was black-clad, bassist for a band, spiked his hair with Elmer's, and bedded his angels for anything other than romance. But cunningly, so they later recalled, not just the bruised boot's shimmy, their sneakers scuffing concrete till the toes poked bloody through, but a rapture in the star-crossed legs that held them.
Paris is burning. Drugs being just a side effect of modernity, let's call the following true. Say bodies really are cathedrals to something holier than themselves, gleaming white and immaculate from every virgin orifice. Why not? Say it's not rash to ask this silly a perfection of anything. You buried yourself in costume, the self an ill fit. Now your skin's foil thin and laid like newsprint over the bones. There may be a message somewhere in this. Say when you die you crumple in my hands like old flowers, exactly that way. Say your comeuppance leaves you chastened, as gratefully diminished as the grape-stained Sunday crowd. Say I swear it. If you argue burnt sinuses and nosebleeds are a bum's communion, let God's be the face reflected when the whole world begs to differ.
For dedications by type and narrative, as suggested in the photographs of Catherine Lord. 1. John Cage, to whom it may concern. Type, a dedication to the readers. Narrative. John Cage was really into outlines. He outlined almost everything, sometimes using the standard Roman numeral and letter format, sometimes using a system of hand-drawn images. One of these image outlines began with a small picture of an oak tree, followed by its lobed leaf, followed by its acorn. The outline moved through a maple, elm, and pine, tree by tree, leaf to needle, seed and cone. He once outlined everything in his apartment until he had a working forest. It was right before a move, and he wanted an organized system to map out the new place. He also made outlines of non-botanical objects. He would lie a pair of scissors, a mug, a fork, his glasses, or whatever, flat on a piece of paper and trace its edges. He outlined more smaller objects than larger ones, primarily because they fit more easily on a sheet of paper, but he outlined numerous big things as well, a sofa, the bedside table, a friend's truck. For these, he used adjoining sheets of paper, or vacant lots. For dedications by type and narrative, as suggested in the photographs of Catherine Lord. 2. Joanna Russ. This book is dedicated to Anne, to Mary, and to the other 1¾ billions of us. Type. A dedication to demonstrate the personal as political. Narrative. Joanna Russ refused to step on AstroTurf, so she never walked on most athletic playing fields. She called the turf Chemgrass, its first name coined by employees of Monsanto Company, the turf's first makers. The corporation was also one of the main reasons Joanna Russ rarely ate at restaurants. She knew Monsanto, or one of its subsidiaries, provided the genetically modified seeds, herbicides, and pesticides that eventually turned into the breads and salads on the restaurant's unthinking menus. Joanna Russ saw Chemgrass as the future of food, but felt she already couldn't trust soy to just be soy. She insisted, rightly so, that if business makes produce, the same is true for you and me. We are made, non-organically. The only question is who or what does the making. Joanna Russ was known to make a very mean navy bean stew. For dedications by type and narrative, as suggested in the photographs of Catherine Lord. 3. James Baldwin. For Lucian. I am the man. I suffered. I was there. Whitman. Type. A dedication to feel and be felt. Narrative. James Baldwin liked to wander through strange cities. He learned street corners could be deceptive, and intersections often led to parallel roads. Main thoroughfares provided one kind of study. He described them as crowded habits, well-grooved and finely made, yet hardly known. Alleyways were another. He liked to wait in cul-de-sacs and see who might come next. he knew to be careful. For while the cities he wandered through were strange because he was new to them, they weren't new to him. He knew their reputations, how they would see him either as a threat or not at all. One time, on a very small street in the middle of a mid-sized city in the middle part of the United States, James Baldwin met a man he'd known in a very large city in the southern part of Europe. It had been several years since they'd seen each other, and their sudden meeting came with the equally sudden recognition of passing fashion. Four dedications by type and narrative, as suggested in the photographs of Catherine Lord. 4. Jill Johnston. This book is for my mother, who should have been a lesbian, and for my daughter, in hopes she will be. Type. A dedication to fuck it up. Narrative. Jill Johnston thought of herself as an everyday kind of gal. Her reasoning was simple. Every day she woke up, and every day she did the same kinds of things everyone else did every day, too. She ate, she brushed her teeth, she put on socks, she misplaced her keys. She wished somebody would say something clever or witty or even just old-fashioned funny. She wished some people would go away. She thought of things she wished she would have said and included those lines in the stories she later told about the thing that actually happened. Because people should always say what they should have said.
The scent of lilac unfurling in the garden in the morning as Phoebus rubs oil on the sun sucks. The soldiers are already taken, their wives are too loyal, their daughters too young, and their sons won't look twice at an old man with a stiff crotch and a flaccid tongue. Whatever. It's not like my knee's still bend that well anyway. Love is done. They said you kicked Heraclitus, and I had to call off the library to prevent the wreck of volumes A through L. I cried that much. You still remember those rocky nights when we talked so long the gods put an extra fuse in the sun to punish our eyes the following dawn? No, of course you don't remember. Ashes have no memories. You don't even know you were a poet once, one of the best. They say, as death was pulling you down, death, the guy famous for reticence, your words lifted from his lips like a bird. Varanius, it's true I have 300,000 friends and twice as many followers, but trust me, I always read your letters first. And now you're coming home. How is Andorra? Be sure to bring something nice for your mom, and slightly less nice for your sisters, since they seem to have forgotten you. But for me, Catullus, your A1 pal, just bring me your lips packed with gossip, the parades and pratfalls you plunder so well, and your beautiful eyes filled with rivers and thighs and mountains and tunics pulled tight by the wind, and your chest perfumed with fine foreign air, and your feet still warm and soft from the shore. When I kiss you, Varanius, I want to taste the world.
Marcus Island by Bernice Carlino. It's so early in the morning and I, Blackidano, the self-proclaimed virtu writer woman, am already so terminally hip. Imagine, I'm sitting back on the crumpled sheets on top of my mattress. My legs look seriously stretched before me, left leg crossed over right, perfectly poised, wearing my typical uniform, black blazer over a crisp white button-down shirt, tucked into slim black trousers with hems just kissing my ankles, exposing wine-colored socks on top of black patent leather Oxfords. My short hair is tucked neatly behind my ears, and my eyes are hidden behind dark glasses, lenses perfectly round for that vintage retro feel. In my right hand I have a cigarette, and in my left hand I have a goblet of brandy. I'm intermittently taking deep drags and heady sips as I survey the remarkable scenery around me. How brown, how clear and brown. Everything around me is brown. You see, last night a typhoon raged. I forget what it's called, but some very Filipino-sounding name anyway. Something nobody uses except to name typhoons. Let's say Anding. So last night, this bitch typhoon Anding spit her icy breath into the whirling air, fat globs of her spittle leaking down and reducing the usually dusty, dry dirt of Barangay Concepcion Uno into one gigantic bowl of mud soup being stirred by the sky gods. The sky gods must have knocked their heads together and said, "The taste is much too strong. Can we add more water still?" And that's what they did. Now here I am, on a desert island, minus the desert, plus this whole gigantic soup full of flood. From where I float on my mattress island, I can see the mud soup blurping against two rows of roofs that used to be P. Gomez Street, where I lived. There, see, that red roof is mine. I wonder if I can still return and live in that house. I don't even fucking own it. It's my parents' second home. I claimed it after they took my younger siblings and left for the nicer one in New Manila. I wonder how they are, if they're safe. I wonder what the fuck I should do now. Well, my parents, assuming their nice new house survived this flood, welcome back their 22-year-old cross-dressing, deadbeat daughter with grand illusions of being the first Filipino winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. Before the bitch and ding came to my life and ripped away everything I owned, I lived on alcohol, cigarettes, and the strained goodwill of my parents. Not so much on food. Well, I guess it's a good thing I've gotten skeletally thin lately. Good for floating on my mattress in the flood. Who knew my badass lifestyle had that particular perk? See, last night, when the evacuators were slamming on my door, yelling, get out now, I was as calm as anything, smoking a joint on top of my bed, watching the rain outside the big picture window in my room. It had been raining for forever, and I was too immersed watching the raindrops slash and smack on the glass to pay those dudes any real attention. Even though the house has only one fucking floor, I never dreamed the water would actually rise, you know, inside, but rise it did, and alarmingly fast. But since I was so fucking high anyway, I watched that too, the flood rising, fascinated with all the brown pooling around me. Then when the flood was lapping at the wood frame of my bed, I knew it was time to go. But suddenly I didn't want to leave my bed, my sweet companion for the past who knows how many days now. So I threw away my joint, which is all smoked up anyway, and kicked the pillows off my bed and grabbed all my mattress island necessities and wrapped them inside my blanket and pulled open the glass of my huge picture window and then flew out like whoosh. I launched my mattress outside the house and I rode the flood like I was riding a fucking skateboard down a ramp. I rode like one of those skater punks, or maybe a surfer beach babe, except, of course, my mattress island necessities consisted exactly of booze and cigs and not much fucking else, and I'd forgotten my goddamn umbrella. So I rode the flood looking as badass as a drenched cat. Luckily, the wind wasn't too strong. It was just rain, all rain, like that asshole Ondoy some years ago. I gave up trying to be a badass skateboarder and sat down on my mattress instead and took cover under my blanket. But of course, the rain dripped down my clothes anyway, and I couldn't smoke because my cigarette got all soggy, so I drank instead and waited for the bitch ending or whoever to shut her fucking mouth and finally subside. I sat on my mattress and floated on the flood and drank a good many cocktails of 50% brandy, 50% rain. I was weeping a little because I had to leave home, but after some cocktails, the world got all mellow and nice and stayed that way. Thank God. And the night closed and took with it the rain, and the sun came out baking hot, so right about now I'm half dried up already. I throw away my soggy, useless blanket, and pull out my dark glasses from my breast pocket, and if anyone comes out and sees me, well fuck that, I'm wearing my vintage sunglasses for maximum swag effect, and sitting pretty, as if I wasn't sobbing like an infant the night before. I have to say, it's not easy to be chill while floating on this flood. For one, it smells like a sea of gazillion, billion, million liquefied soggy shoes. Pure putrefaction, leather and rubber and canvas in their most glorious state of decay, stuffed roughly into my mouth, gagging me. So I take another brandy shot, then another, anything to take the edge off the flood's violent attack on my delicately burgessy senses. If you can get over the overpowering stench of the flood, though, it's really rather serene otherwise, like being in a gently swaying boat out on the picturesque oceanscape. My mattress bobs slowly and softly over the water, and the rhythm is not frightening at all. It's like a pool party, almost. My neighbors are boogieing on their respective roofs, unashamed, irreverent toward the deaths that have surely happened elsewhere. Some of my neighbors have not quite caught the boogie fever and prefer to poke instead at debris swishing past as the flood weaves around the double line of houses and around the beaten bald tops of trees. I am one such swishing debris, and when the neighbors see me floating past, they laugh and wave at me. I'm sort of known around here as the neighborhood is eccentric, and I'm proud of it. I wear the label like a name tag across my breast and tip my glass to them for the acknowledgement. They riot at the hilarity. And I wave back grandly because I'm drunk, because I'm high, because this whole thing is way too fucking weird. As the street parties and anticipate salvation, here I am almost wishing I live on this flood, on this liquid mountain of putrefying shoes, forever. Here I have no responsibilities. Here I can be drunk and stay drunk and wave at people and not have to feel weird about it. I float without aim or direction. I steer away from roofs and particularly huge debris by using an empty brandy bottle as my makeshift oar. I never drift too far away from P. Gomez, which is good because it's all very, very nice here. Some sparrows fly down close to where I am floating. How pretty! The birdies are flying, all panicky, fluttering as if searching for a piece of land after the great flood. I'm watching them happily until, for some strange reason, they fly right up to my fucking face and rest on my body, seeming to equate my shoulders with branches on which to perch, which I do not like at all. What if they leave ugly white poop stains on my beautiful rich black blazer? So I swat the wretched sparrows away wildly, but in doing so I relinquish the perfectly arranged equilibrium of my placement on the mattress, and it sinks in one corner. I lose my balance and have to flail desperately, rearranging my ass on the mattress for the whole thing to float correctly once more. From now on, I must remember to just sit still and enjoy the scenery and drink and smoke. This aloneness keeps my mattress afloat. Buoyancy is fragile. Just as I'm dwelling on this, one of my neighbors, a dude around my age, who I think comes from 17 P. Gomez, suddenly calls out my name. I'm too close to pretend I haven't heard, so I sigh and go over to his house. He and his mother and father and two little sisters are happily waving me over. When I get close, he asks, "Can you be driver for us?" I light another cigarette and take care to blow the smoke away from the kids and ask what he means. He says, "We sit on bed and then all of us ride to dry place." The mother chimes in, "First Maria, then Mina." The father chimes in, "Then Mrs." The dude my age explains, "Ride them, then come back here." Then, I'm last riding. His mother says to him, "Blessed you are by God." His father says, "How kind is my Miguel?" That's when I speak up and say that this mattress, though surely epic and excellent, unfortunately doesn't work that way. It can only carry one passenger at a time, just me. So I'm truly sorry for their plight, and I hope help comes soon from the relief operations or that the water goes down as fast as when the bathtub plunger is yanked out, and when it does and everything's over and done with and the houses in Pico are shiny and new again, they can be sure I'll visit their sparkling clean home and bring over a large bowl of buko salad for a potluck dinner if I didn't know jack shit about cooking. But none of them are listening. They're busy consulting with each other about who should go with me first, if the girl should go first to be safer the sooner, or if their mother should so that she'll be ready to take care of the girls when they get there. And the father's loudly calling out to his neighbors on either side, 16 and 18 P. Gomez, and sharing with them that, bravo, they have found a fairy woman to save them all. What's my name again? I reply meekly, Blackie Daniel. And I really truly think they're a lovely family, not unlike my own, with a personable father and a caring mother and a rough and tumble kuya who's kind and brave deep down and younger siblings with eyes that shine like hope. We're all lovely, really, but you know, I have to go. In this mattress island, I'm alone, isolated even from the littlest, lightest sparrows. So I begin to murmur excuses and row away with my trusty brandy bottle, but I barely go a few feet, when Miguel calls out, "Hoy, Blackie, where are you going?" Then a splash, I turn around and I'm horrified to see that he's dived right into the stinky flood to chase after me. He swims toward me using the doggy paddle, his head bobbing up and down the water. He's grinning as if he thinks I know this is some sort of game. Then, horror of horrors, he calls out to his friends from other houses. "Hoy, Jun! Hoy, Santi! Hoy, Elena! Hoy, Boy! Hoy, Mimi! Catch her!" I hear a chorus of splashes from behind me as they jump into the flood to support him. I look around and see they all swim faster than I can row with my little bottle. Their arms are so much stronger. They close in with swift, sure strokes. Then Miguel's hand reaches the edge of my mattress and grabs it hard. His friends are hot on his heels and quickly swarm in a circle around me, each grabbing the edges of the mattress on every side. The weight is too much for my fragile mattress to take, and from all the pressure of so many people, it seeps in the flood water and sinks from beneath me. I find myself submerged in the brown water and I am gasping for air. But hands quickly grab me from all sides and I feel myself being dragged some distance through the murky depths and then finally pulled up a rough surface angling up. The surface claws on me as I'm dragged upward, tearing my shirt and digging wounds into my back. I gasp again, water spurting out of my mouth. My terminally hip, circular dark glasses have fallen off and my eyes are already open. And all I see is no longer brown, brown, brown. Now I can see an immaculately glowing blue sky above. I'm on a roof. It's so high up here, safer, closer to this lovely sky. God damn it, it's beautiful. Then slowly all my other senses return to me, and I can hear a little girl crying, "Mommy, Mommy, dead already?" The father screams to his son, "Motherfucker, kid is this?" Miguel says sheepishly, "Sorry already." He is echoed by his other friends who have swum here to the roof of 17 P. Gomez to save me. They tell me the mattress sank and overturned and everything on it was lost. My brandy, my cigarettes, my mattress island necessities. Motherfucking mattress island necessities. What bullshit. I sit up and tell them, "Hey, that's alright, I'm alive, but direly in need of a hug." I open up my arms and make goo-goo eyes at the little girl who was crying, Mina or Maria. And she wipes her tears and snot away with the back of her hand, shyly takes a step toward me, then throws herself into my arms. After a moment's hesitation, her sister, Maria or Mina, jumps forward and hugs me as well. One of the sisters asks me, "Okay already, ate?" And I echo, "Okay already." My hair is standing up like a demented starfish and my shirt is now brown and so are my slacks and don't even get me started about my patent leather Oxfords. But who fucking cares right now? None of that shit matters. I've got company. I'm alive. And so, stranded together, we all boogie as we wait for help, together for help to arrive.
Lobster Apologia, Ingram Wilkinson. I seem to have woken up in an aquarium, a place littered with lichens, with corals, with snapping lobsters having left their dirty homes for the cavities of my own body. I turn to face the young boy, the sleeping young boy, and in the silence of early morning I offer him my confessions. I am a nervous person. I have arthritis. I remember everything. There's more to it, of course, like the story of my father, how a sunburnt body inhaled steam from the stovetop, how he would throw the clicking invertebrates into the pot before running out to the spigot for more water. There's more to it, of course. There's my stepmother's homemade tea and all the apologies of a highly anticipated Saturday night. Sorry for the bony elbows, I say to you. Sorry we were drunk. Sorry about the whole episode in the cab, how I lost my breath when saying your name aloud. That's what this is, after all, something underwater, a place that knows only the suggestion of sunlight. I am in here. I yelled to the kitchen while struggling to hold my filled bucket. "Get me that water," he said. "Get me the giant knife from the dishwasher. We're going to finish them off. We're eating lobster tonight." I poured my water into theirs and watched as their claws grasped for a shoreline made of sand, not copper. "Sorry for making the noise," one's eyes seemed to say. "Sorry for making you guilty." I stared at their backless forms and touched my own spine while you hollowed their tails. Mom, as you made me call her, she lit a candle on the back porch and asked me to say the blessing while sipping her tea. You wanted me. "Dear God," I say, "dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the idea of spines. Thank you for his body and its freckled thighs, the way it moved over me like sunlight over reeds. Thank you. No, this is wrong. Sorry, God," I say. "Sorry for fucking a man and saying your name aloud, Father, but when you ask me to say the blessing, some people have got to be named. Dear body, dear lobsters, please come sit down. We've got some food left over, and my stepmother has left the table. Dear boy, dear last night, please keep me hidden. I don't want the sun anymore. Let's drown here and sleep forever. Sorry for the bony spine. Sorry in advance for the goodbye kiss and for already planning a real date with cold beer and Japanese movies." "Amen," you say. "Amen, amen," and you pass me the plate. Father, you pass the good china before I drop everything with my clumsy, aching fingers. Our night begins with a small disaster, the broken plate falling in love with the floor. "Sorry for breaking everything," I say, wiping the sweat from my arms. You stir and wait for me to speak.